Welcome to Tooled Up Education's Researcher of the Month, where the Tooled Up team selects a paper from a notable researcher that will be of interest to parents and school staff everywhere.
Professor Claudia Bernard is Professor of Social Work at Goldsmiths University. She's also the head of postgraduate research in the Department of Social, Therapeutic and Community Studies. A qualified social worker, Claudia has worked in local authority, children and family social work, and has retained this interest in her research and teaching. She joined Goldsmiths in 1994 and previously held a lectureship at the University of Portsmouth. Her general interests lie in the areas of social work, gender-based violence, critical race theory, equalities and social justice. Welcome, Professor Bernard. How are you?
I'm well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for giving up your time to talk us through your most recent publication, and one that we're celebrating within Tooled Up as our Researcher of the Month for the month of July. And it's a paper entitled A Qualitative Study of the Perspectives of Designated Safeguarding Leads Responding to Child Protection Concerns in Fee-Paying Schools. So it's a very kind of niche area. Claudia, tell us a little bit about why you wanted to deliver this paper. Where was the sort of the gap in the research?
Thank you. And thank you very much for inviting me. I think it was about 2016, 2017, the City of London Corporation approached Goldsmiths, approached me to say basically they had a problem and they were looking for a research solution to address the problem. And that problem was that in relation to their safeguarding, they had a number of child neglect cases coming up, and those children were from affluent families. And it was something that had been coming up over the years, and they didn't know how to respond to the problem in relation to their safeguarding procedures. So they asked me to go find out, well, what research is out there and what do we know about child neglect in family? Because often child neglect in particular, it's often associated with poverty and deprivation. And I did a scoping review for them to see what research was out there. And there wasn't any, in the UK context, there wasn't any research at all. But I did come across two serious case reviews that had been published, one in 2011 and one in 2014, that had focused on children from affluent background. And there had been some research done in the US. There's a lot more research done in the US about affluent neglect, but in the UK there was nothing. So they then asked me to do a piece of empirical research for them to find out really from those affluent parts of England, is it something that's coming up and how do professionals respond to that? So that's what I did, an original piece of research, qualitative piece of research, where I interviewed social workers, managers, early help professionals, a whole range of professionals who work in children's services across England, in the wealthiest part of England. And a key factor that came up was around how child protection services liaised and communicated and worked in partnership with safeguarding leads in fee-paying schools. So that led me to do a further piece of research to actually find out from safeguarding leads in private schools themselves, what are their experiences of addressing this problem.
And I think you interviewed about 33 of them, which is fantastic. But can I just backtrack a little bit for people listening who may not be that familiar with the terminology affluent neglect? I think we associate child neglect, as you say, with sort of poverty and deprivation. And what does affluent neglect look like? What is it? What is there a sort of a definition?
Well, there are some schools of thought that think that there is a particular different category of affluent neglect, and criteria and the sort of issues that's raised in relation to thinking about affluent neglect is, you know, briefly, where parents provide a lot of material resources to their children, but very little of themselves and very little emotional connection with their children. And also the other factor that's identified is a sort of a lot of pressure on children from affluent background to achieve. Also that sort of pressure that's put on children to achieve, to get into the best universities, to get into the best music schools, etc., etc. And that concept and that term is used mainly in the US, that kind of concept of affluent neglect. I think in the UK here, we don't use that concept so readily. But I think that the challenge is actually in the definition of child neglect. And child neglect is very broadly defined as the persistent failure to meet a child's basic physical and or psychological needs, likely to result in the serious impairment of the child's health and development. Well, that's very broad. And I think in the UK here, we try and think about the different categories and the different types of neglect. So there is physical neglect, there is educational neglect, emotional neglect, and medical neglect. And the issue that comes up more readily for children from affluent background is around emotional neglect. And emotional neglect is by and far the hardest category of neglect to actually define and have clear, consistent evidence.
That's right. And obviously very hard to observe or, you know, find sort of evidence for. And it's very easy as well to sort of deny.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. And so your paper, you interviewed 33 designated safeguarding leads. Can you tell us a little bit about that specific role within fee-paying schools? What does it sort of cover?
Well, within it all, whether it's fee-paying or state schools or children's services, the designated safeguarding lead has a key responsibility in promoting the welfare of children and promoting their safeguarding in environments. So, and being alert to addressing issues of child abuse and neglect that arises for children. So it's a key role in terms of in schools for providing some leadership and some guidance and framework and training there for other staff who may be working more directly on a day-to-day basis with children who are more likely to be able to observe any change in behaviours or any particular things that might raise concerns about neglect.
And how did the DSLs respond to your invitation to take part in those roundtable discussions? I'm sort of curious. Did they welcome it? Did they, you know?
Yes, and they were really keen to take part. And I had been invited to speak to a couple of conferences in private schools, and they really engaged with it. So some of the DSLs that I recruited came from those invitations in particular conferences. When I did the research for the City of London, I had a small advisory group who was guiding the research, and one member of that advisory group was the safeguarding lead for one of the schools in the City of London. So there was engagement with the research from the start, from DSLs, because I think they recognised that they have some particular challenges and they needed to find ways and share experiences of dealing with it. So they were very keen to engage with the study.
So one of the things I think you found, which is very interesting, that perhaps safeguarding thresholds for emotional neglect perhaps weren't as well understood. And you can imagine why. You know, in that particular area that you mentioned of emotional neglect, you know, it can be quite easy to just think, is it something or nothing? How could you even begin a conversation with a parent about those particular, you know, suspicions? Or tell us a little bit more about that. And was that a central finding?
Yes, that was a central finding of this study and also the study that I did with social workers and professional helpers in children's services. Before I respond to that, important to say that there are other forms of abuse being identified, like sexual abuse, physical abuse as well, emotional abuse as well. Emotional abuse distinctive from emotional neglect, because I think sometimes they kind of use interchangeably, but they're very different kinds of things. So in terms of thresholds, because neglect generally anyway is the most significant in terms of referrals that are made to children's services, neglect is always the highest than physical and sexual abuse and other forms of abuse. And neglect is very difficult to identify anyway in relation to, because it's not a one-off incident, maybe like physical abuse that may be a one-off. You have to be able to notice patterns over a period of time and you notice some things. And the obvious things around, in terms of the indicators and the signs and indicators for neglect, is often looking at whether or not children are turning up at school, whether they are, you know, they are well dressed, you know, they're not scruffy looking or unwashed. And if you're going into the homes of families, you know, the indicators it suggests is, you see, is the home clean? Is there food? Is there all those kinds of basic? Well, in terms of thinking about affluent children, well, those kinds of things would not be so obvious, unless sometimes if there are mental health difficulties, parental mental health difficulties, or alcohol abuse or substance misuse, which for some of the children in the first study, those issues were also there, and domestic abuse was also in those homes. Whereas with neglect, there has to be particular things that you're looking for in relation to children's behaviour that might indicate. And we know that with neglect, that it's when children get into adolescence and that age, that the behavioural problems may start to manifest itself. So the children might have been neglected throughout their early childhood, but it manifests itself in a really visible way in mostly adolescent teenage years, where the behavioural acting out. The issue about the threshold is that, and I think that's where power and social class comes in. Affluent parents, a different kind of approach is taken, a different kind of lens. So different language is used when it comes to affluent parents. So their parenting might not be described as neglectful. It might be described as permissive kind of parenting. They're more liberal, and, you know, there is those kinds of, that kind of language changes. So it masks really what's sometimes going on for children. Because I think probably deep in people's thinking is that notion that neglect is associated with deprivation. So therefore, certainly in the first study, it was found that the benefit of the doubt is given to affluent parents in a different way, because the affluent parent have the means, to the power, the gravitas to actually intervene in a different way and put a stop to any intervention, that assessment that a professional social worker might be attempting to do. Affluent parents are much more likely to put a stop to that very early on, so we don't really get the evidence in that same way.
You're making me think that almost a litmus test for that social worker is, or DSL in a school, is separating out that traditional image of neglect. Yeah. And thinking about the facts on the page.
Yeah.
And thinking, would I be reframing it in this way if we were dealing with parents of a lower socioeconomic status?
Yeah.
So it's almost trying to be very careful in our sort of approach and making sure there are no blind spots in that sort of assessment.
And that's correct. And the difference is with families from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, they, you know, they may come into the social work offices and shout, and they may threaten, but they don't have the social capital in the same way to go directly to the director of children's services, to go directly to the headmaster or headmistress of the school in the way that affluent parents do, or go directly to their local MPs or whoever, you know, in terms of that social capital. So something different happens there to prevent a proper scrutiny of what's going on for that child. And often the parents don't allow the social workers to have access to the children. And although, you know, there are powers and in terms of the legislative framework, but there's less reluctance to go down the route of doing an unannounced visit, for example, that you might do in other circumstances if you have concerns. But it wouldn't happen with affluent families.
So if anything, being a DSL in those sort of fee-paying schools sounds like a tough job, because there seem to be barriers to be overcome that may not exist in other settings.
I think so. There are some different barriers, in that because parents and the school have a different kind of relationship, a transactional relationship. So there are different sort of power relations going on there. And again, as I said before, that these are parents with the social and the cultural capital to actually get things done their way. And social class is very powerful in terms of actually having conversations with those difficult conversations with somebody who has the power to actually put a stop to it, or bring their, you know, bring their legal advocates with them to meetings, or that's if they're not legal advocates themselves. So it puts a different frame in.
And Claudia, is there sort of as an experienced social worker yourself, I know you've worked, you know, you're a professor of social work. I know DSLs will be listening to this and thinking, oh gosh, is there a template? Is there an optimal way to be opening up that dialogue with that parent that they should be using, leaning into, that would develop a sufficient rapport to ensure that that relationship is collaborative and they can voice those suspicions and concerns in an optimal way? Because a lot of, you know, DSLs aren't trained social workers, or they don't have that training. So it seems to be a little bit of a gap.
And specifically the first piece of research that I did, the one area where there was really good practice going on in terms of working together, and the children's services department in that particular geographical area, which was a very affluent part of the country, and nearly all the services that families used, including the schools, but all the services, dentists, doctors, all the services were private practitioners. So that local authority did quite a lot of training and working and sort of working together to have some shared understanding, and training together to have shared understanding. So the schools have to be part of that kind of network as well, working closely in part of that to have those discussions, to because that made it easier. And it was also the DSLs that were more experienced, had more practice wisdom, were much more able to actually not be intimidated in a way by parents, and not losing focus on the child and keeping the child as the center of any discussions that were taking place with the parents. And I think because the parents, some of the parents are very demanding in a way, that you could, that some of the focus on the child is sometimes lost, because all the time is taken up with responding to parents. So it was the DSL that were more experienced and had more gravitas and were able to actually address the issues with their headmasters or headmistresses were the ones that were much more likely to not lose focus on the child, keep the child at the centre of any concerns.
So it sounds like if you were a DSL, having a lot of collaborative partnerships locally is very important, and having a sort of a network even of other DSLs who could sort of almost in a supervisory role, you know, sticking together is a really good idea, I think, in this particular area, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was the DSLs who said, you know, they had good relationships with children's services, key workers, so that they were able to ring up and sort of, to, you know, I'm having a little bit of concerns here, just talk through that kind of, is this something I should be concerned about? It's those kinds of conversations and relationships that can really, really kind of help.
Yes, who've been able to pick up the phone and say, look, I'm mulling this over. Does that sound right? What is that, you know, would you advise? So even before you have a conversation with any parent, that you would speak to another professional about those sorts of concerns.
In some areas, it's much more challenging for the, particularly in boarding schools, for the DSL to have that kind of relationship with one partnership area, because the children are coming from all over the country, all over the globe, sort of thing. So it's much more challenging, you know, in that way.
And with international students, I mean, it must be so difficult for a DSL to navigate their own original context, or, you know, even potentially develop a rapport that's, you know, good enough with the parents to be able to challenge things. And that might even have to be done online. So what advice would you have in that regard?
Well, again, that came up as a real challenge for the DSLs, particularly the ones in boarding schools, particularly where parents have different values and belief systems about how children should be brought up, how children should be disciplined, those DSLs are often walking a tightrope in terms of where they might have real concerns, but feeling confident enough to address that with parents who have some very different values about what you do with children. But I think the main message, I think, is really how do schools, how do DSLs and all the relevant pastoral staff, how do they have those discussions among themselves and their training and their learning events to develop good practice? Because I don't think there isn't a kind of a toolkit. You can say, you know, you do this when it's this group of family, when it's children from this country, you need to do that. When it's Nigerian children, you need to do that. When it's Russian children, you need to do that. I think often people are looking for something easier, some tools that we can use. But I think the main thing is having those conversations between themselves.
Each other, that's right, and developing that kind of peer support and structure.
Yeah, and in having difficult conversations.
So this particular theme of affluent neglect, if you were the head of a school, a headmistress, you know, we know that there are guidance documents. We find one by a particular law firm on affluent neglect, but that's on the legal side. What are the things that you would put in place for sure to support the DSLs, to cover yourselves legally? And in terms of training, what's best out there? Maybe you even do the training yourself, Claudia, but tell us what's optimal in that regard. If you were leading a school, what would you like to see?
And I think some of the schools have already started to do it, because some of the schools have the first piece of research. Some of the schools have incorporated that into their policy, their safeguarding policy, and make reference to it. And also, I think with the research, schools might think, how might we use this research in our training and learning events? How might we use this research, some key findings from this research, when we're having our induction session with new parents who, you know, are open day? Are those kinds of things. In terms of training, at this point, I only know of one region, Windsor and Maidenhead, that part of the country, where the children's services, in terms of the first piece of research, they use that piece of research to develop a training module that they do annually for their staff. But I know children's services and their partnership, but I don't know if any of the fee-paying schools in that region participate in the research. So I would say it's using the research and thinking, well, could we develop anything from this? How can we use it in our learning event, you know, conversations we're having with parents?
And I really like the idea of bringing the parents with you on this journey. So it's not one against the other, but actually educating, which we try and do in Tooled Up, educating parents about parenting, about what we know is optimal for children based on the evidence base, and sort of educating alongside.
Yeah.
And really, it's about early intervention and preventing situations of the type that you've described really coming to, you know, growing.
Yes, exactly. And DSLs will have a different conversation with that cohort of parents, because the affluent parents may not see, well, what is the problem? The children have nannies, they're well looked after, they have people driving them to school, they're not left on their own as such. So they may not see, well, what is the fuss about? But it's the emotional, there's something there around that in terms of neglect, there is this sort of omission or commission, whether or not it's deliberate or whether or not it's by omission, that parents are not understanding. Well, if you've been living abroad for a year and you haven't seen your children for a whole year, then that's going to have some kind of impact on the children, even if you are FaceTiming them once a day. But there is still something that's going to be emotionally, that's going to be a deficit for children. It's those kinds of different conversations that you'd have if you're having a conversation with parents who are having seeing their children every day and doing the kinds of things that parents do with children, you know, talking to them and paying attention and holding them centrally all the time, which is what parents have to do, hold their children as the most important things in their children's needs above their own.
And also attuning to your child, you know, looking, you know, being sensitive to things they're saying, you know, and picking up on things. One of our little tooled up tips in our organization is that we always ask parents to ask their children how they feel family life is going. Children always have an opinion. And sometimes they will say they're not going to complain about they don't have enough holidays. It's often about I don't see you enough or I don't like living with grandma, or that they tell you. And I think having a sense of democracy in family life is a really nice thing for families, for all of us to ask our children, you know, do that sort of family audit, as we call it.
Exactly, exactly. And particularly if children are in boarding school, if they're away for months, particularly when they're going into adolescence, you don't see those changes that happen so rapidly, emotionally and physically and psychologically, to kind of tune in. So I think it's different kind of conversations about parenting that has to be had with particular groups of affluent parents.
And equally, technology for children in boarding school, having that dialogue with parents on technology, you can still have a great conversation. You can ask them how they're doing, thinking and feeling, but it does require greater partnership between home and school, doesn't it, to just keep that information channel flowing quite openly.
Yeah.
And Claudia, tell us, what are you working on now? Because you did that original study, you've produced this paper, and where is that going to take you next in terms of this particular topic?
In terms of this particular topic, I'm thinking about, because since doing the original piece of research, I've only recently started to keep track of them. I've had about 20 people have contacted me, no adults, who said that was exactly their experiences when they were children. So I'm kind of toying with the idea of whether or not I could do something, again, a similar roundtable or discussion or one-to-one, maybe for some one-to-one, because some of those people are not in the best place at the moment. But so I'm thinking of that in relation to whether or not I could do something with young people, adults, who have themselves had particular experiences in fee-paying schools and now navigating their lives as adults, young adults. Yeah, so that's around this area. Because this area was not somewhere I set out to do, most of my research is around children's experiences in child welfare services and looking at social class and race and gender. So that's why I was asked to do this piece of research. But I didn't have a long-term plan. But I equally have noticed that not many people in the neglect field in the UK are still not really addressing this topic at all.
And you mentioned in America, this was a bigger literature from that sort of environment. Are there any key researchers working in this area abroad that might be quite useful for people here to tap into and read and research?
Yes, there is a key researcher, Luthra, her name is. I'm sorry, I can send that to you afterwards. But they are not looking so much at child protection services or the legal services or welfare services. It's looking more psychologically what happens to young people in terms of psychological and emotional health problems. But it certainly is worth looking at, because in the US they have much more residential schools where parents can just put their children if young people are starting to get involved in substance misuse or drugs misuse in their early adolescent teens. They can force their children into these kinds of residential boarding schools that deal with their problem, the children's problem.
Those kind of boot camps that are, see sort of, televised and things like that. So it's kind of the problem has been sent to the boot camp.
Yeah, the problem is the child. It's not us. It's not us that we've neglected our child for all these years, that they have all these emotional problems now. So it's a bit, it's very different.
I think there's a bigger educational piece here. I mean, I'm a loving, aspirational parent, you know, and I expect my children to do well at school, et cetera, and nudge them towards things. But I think there's a bigger educational piece for all of us about, again, the auditing of how our children are responding to our parenting for all of us.
Yeah.
And also making sure that we're never providing material things out of a sense of guilt, out of, you know, thinking about our own motivations for the provision of those resources.
Yeah.
And I think remembering that children always long for us and our attention and our love and our praise. So I think there's a bigger educational piece for all of us based on the sort of the research that you've done.
Yes, I think so. Yes, I agree.
Well, Claudia, thank you so much for your time. I'm sure we'll be back in touch, because I think introducing your work to teachers in particular, people working in school, and spreading the word about this area and learning more about it would be very, very fruitful in the future. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This podcast is brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life and education. www.tooledupeducation.com. Parents and teachers in Tooled Up schools can also access notes accompanying each podcast, available to read and download from the Tooled Up site.